So now we're going to jump into each of these sections, these eight sections, and what you need to document from a documentation point of view, from a perspective there. Resource description, URL methods, and so forth. Okay, so this first one, a resource description. This essentially just is a description of what is contained by this resource. Now, exactly what you call these varies a bit, right? People may refer to this as like an endpoint description, a method description, but I've called them resource descriptions here because the model of REST has this idea of resources that you're accessing on the web. So this is usually a brief 1 to 3 sentence description. It often starts with a verb like returns information about yada yada yada, and it's not really that extensive. Although you could see by that Aris Weather API that you might have a lot more to say about things if you have a robust API. Here's an example from Eventbrite. If you look at their API on events, their description basically says allows you to retrieve a paginated response of public event objects. You know, so it's not lengthy. As I said, this is often referred to by different names, which we'll try to sort out when we standardize with the OpenAPI. The OpenAPI actually calls them paths, which actually aren't used that much. But the one I like, in addition to resource descriptions, might just be like endpoint description. Okay. Second part is the resource URL. Question in the back.
Is that where you would define valid values?
No. The valid values is going to be in your parameters or your in the requests, like what parameters the request can have. Could be in the response, although usually a valid value would be the request. But yeah, the request. Any other question? All right, the resource URL. This is the path that you use in that request in order to send the request. Now there's something called a base path that comes before it that's the same for everything. And then what you tack onto the end of the base path is usually the end point, and that's what you list here in the URL section, this end point after the base path. So the base path is just like what every request uses, like HTTPS :// mycompany.api.com/v1/, and then all the endpoints are home or whatever it is, group, you know, pet, whatever. Okay, now, there's not a whole lot to say about this part. Here's an example with, let's see, this is the Instagram API, sorry. So you can see here the part that they're highlighting is just this endpoint, users self follows, users self followed by. And sometimes this URL will actually have a parameter in it, which we'll talk about it next. But a lot of times this URL is used as the kind of title of your section. It's what groups things. You might have one resource that has a lot of different URLs that all access it. It sort of depends on your API. Here, for example, in the left column, you can see that they've got the endpoint, they call them endpoints, is relationships. But within relationships, they have multiple resource URLs. You've got the get users self follows, you've got the get users self followed by, and so forth. This comes back to API design. How many different resource URLs do you have per, you know, resource? You could have a lot. You could have one with a million options to configure it.
From the source perspective of this, like when they have developed an API, mm-hmm. is this a file structure, this path? I've never seen what it actually looks like from the giving perspective. I've only seen it from this perspective.
Wait, you're asking me what if
library structure anymore, but from as when they create these resources, mm-hmm. What does that look like on their server?
What do these resources look like on their server? Well, all of these resources are just accessed through that long URL. So I don't know if I'm entirely understanding the question, but like from the engineer side of how they create these resources, I don't know a lot about like the actual like if they have a database where this information is stored that then is like accessed through these different requests. I imagine there's a lot of different ways they could architect it. I'm pretty sure most people do put information in databases. Whether you could do it with flat files, I'm not really sure. There's a lot of different like database designs and so forth. All right, let me go to the next one. Oh, here's an example of a path parameter inside this resource URL. So whenever you have a parameter that's actually part of the path, in this example, this is from MailChimp, when you're sending a campaign, you have to put a campaign ID in there. This, when you have a situation like this, this path parameter is always required. It can't be inserted in any order. And you usually want to try to set it off in a way that people can understand. There's a possibility that somebody would get confused and think that they actually need curly braces around the campaign ID. So you want to make it clear that, you know, the whole thing is just like a variable or a parameter. Okay, the method usually goes right with the resource URL. You usually put it in full caps to the left or something. And this is like get, post, put, delete. These are the operations that this request is using. The get is just getting information. So it's usually something, like if there's ever an API that doesn't have an API key, it probably only offers get requests to provide information. Post means you're actually creating something. Put means you're updating something that already exists. Delete means you're removing something. And there's some others, patch, and you saw that giant list in Postman with some more, but these are the most common. Particularly with the post method, you're gonna have more information that you're submitting, because usually when you create some kind of resource, you have to configure it. Whereas if you're just getting it, you usually don't have a lot more about it. So here's an example. This is from MailChimp. And if you can't read these, by the way, if you want to like follow along on slides and so forth on your own computer, if you're back at the workshop activities under Intro to API Documentation, you just click that and then go out to, dash 10 or something. So available methods here. Okay, where was I? Oh, okay, on the left you can see they specify that these are get methods. But actually, let's go to this for a minute here. I should have this linked, and I do not have this linked. Okay, fine. But if you were to go to this, you can see that they've organized their methods, as they're calling them, or their endpoints, or their resource URLs, in three different groups. You've got your read methods here, you've got your delete ones here, and you've got your action ones here, which would be something other than get or delete. It might be post or something else. So if you have a lot of different methods, you might have to think about how you want to organize them. Does it make sense to do something fancy with tabs that group them? Do you just have one method for the whole resource? You have 12. But there's definitely an organizational question that you would decide. But yeah, you want to, in general, the strategy is that you would group methods by similar operations, put all of your get methods for that resource together, all of your post methods together, and do what would make sense to your API. Okay, parameter section. This is where you define what the valid values are. These are options that you can use with the endpoint. This is like the way you configure the endpoint. There are four types of parameters. You've got a header parameter. These are parameters that are passed in the header part, like the key, the API key usually. A path parameter, this comes before, I showed that with the client ID, it comes before any kind of query string parameters. Query strings are what come after a question mark, and like question mark filter equals whatever, ampersand, and I'll show an example in a minute. And then the request body. So this is an important point that when you have a parameter section, you want to identify what kind of parameter each is. So here is an example. This is with the Box API. And here they've defined that they have path parameters. Oh, did you want, somebody was going to lower the lights. Did you want to?
I did.
Oh.
It's
too dark. Okay.
And it's too dark for certain people.
Oh, no. Well, we were trying to dim just the front. If you want, that might make it more readable. See, she knows what she's doing. This is her room, right?
Does that help?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. Okay. So in this example, you've got path params. You can abbreviate it, I guess. Path parameters, and there are four of them. So these are going to appear right in the path. They're always going to be required. But they've listed them out as query parameters and body parameters. So you've got three different types of parameters that you're calling out. That's why I thought this was a good example, because it shows how to clearly distinguish the two. This one is actually linked, so let's go to it real quick. The Box API is actually, I believe it's on a platform called readme.io. So if we don't get into that later, this is what the stuff on readme looks like. But here you, come on. Oh, it's still loading. Let's see if I can magnify that a bit or not.
Redoc?
I'm pretty sure this is on, oh, could be, but I thought it was on readme. Well, I know, but you can have any domain pointed to this third-party host. Doesn't necessarily indicate where it's hosted. All right, where it's actually living. So here you've got kind of a better view here. Path parameters, query parameters, and so forth. In this example, they've integrated a try it feature. So you can put your own little ID, your own fields, and then you can click try it and execute the request. And what happens is basically the same thing as Postman. It's going to make the request and return the response directly in the user interface, which is a cool feature. This is actually, I'm pretty sure this is a feature within readme. But a lot of other platforms offer this. I mean, you've got all the wiring to make it. It's not a hugely difficult thing. But here on the left, you can see that this file object resource has several different endpoints or requests that you can make around it, downloading, uploading, and so forth. And so they organize it in a way that's very readable. But they group similar endpoints together and so forth. Well, I've magnified it a bit.
Oh, you've got it too. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I missed that. Sorry.
So the responsive view. You know, it would take a lot of effort to build a site like this. And I don't know why nothing is showing in my third pane, but it takes a lot of effort to build a site like this. And so if you have access to a platform like readme, yeah, the suggest edits, that's another readme feature. They sort of build all this in. That said, I don't want to sound like a spokesman for readme. I really did have somebody contact me for a job, and they told me their stuff was on readme, and I was like, awesome choice. And they said, the first task of the API writer will be to get us off readme. It's like, why? It comes back to this point I was making yesterday. Developers want complete freedom to do what they want to do. And if your platform has restrictions, it frustrates them. They want to build it and do it themselves. So At least that was what I got. Okay, let's go to another example here. Now, when you have query string parameters, this is an example. Let's say that your endpoint was surf report, and then you had a path parameter of beach ID. After the question mark come the query string parameters. And here we have days equal 3 and units equal metric and time equals 1400 or something. They can be in any order, but you can't put the path parameter in any order. You couldn't put beach ID in any order. So both of these would be equivalent. You could put time last or first and so forth. And when you have query string parameters, developers might be like, oh, this is a double, or this is a I don't know, 16 integer, you know, different type. Okay, there's lots of different data types for how data is specified in more formal programming languages like Java. For example, this could be a float, a double, and it determines how big it can be. Well, that kind of stuff might be specified in the documentation, but it's not really enforced in the call. So if like a number, which is usually just how it's referred to, if the data type has constraints around it, you would document how big it could be, like your max and min for it. All right. Yeah, on the data types, typically there's just four data types in the query string parameters. You either got a string, which is some kind of alphanumeric letter number, integer, a whole number, 1, 5, 20, a boolean, true or false, or an object, which is a set of key value pairs. And beyond that, you don't have a lot of these more granular data types like you would in Java or something. The request body is often used for post requests, and it would usually be a JSON object. So, and this is very common. You have a request, but then you also have to submit a request body in it. And you would define each of these properties in the request body. The request example usually shows a sample request. Now, typically, because you can put a lot of different query string parameters in there, different values for the path parameters and so forth, the request example is a sample only. It's not going to show like every way that you could submit a request, but you usually have some kind of curl request. So, for example, with let's go to this one. This, I believe, this is the Twitter API. They can be very bare bones about their request example. Example request. Look at that. They just throw it right in there. Not even any fancy formatting. It's like, hey, this is what you can submit, right? And then they show an example response, which is formatted a lot nicer. But here, you often put this sample request in curl just because it's a lot easier. Here's another example. This one, now APIs vary so much. This one is from the New York Times. And here, they're a lot more interactive. You actually construct the whole request over here, and it shows you the response in real time. So like you can have these built-in API explorers. And a lot of these platforms provide this. I think I'm gonna talk about this later. But basically, you can build Postman right into your interface. Not literally Postman, but something like it. Okay. One thing to keep in mind if your company is hot to trot about having an API Explorer built into it is that you actually do submit real requests. So people often don't realize that they're like messing up their data, they're creating stuff that can't be deleted, they're ordering things. I once worked on this product at Amazon called Dash, which allows you to reorder supplies, right? And they had this API for it. And I'm like, this is great, this documentation. You know, you've got all the parts there, but where are the requests? And we need these. You can't have an API documentation reference topic and not show a sample request. And they're like, well, we don't really want people to make requests because they're going to be ordering stuff. They're going to actually be like ordering supplies. I'm like, really? You don't have a test system? So they eventually had to code in some kind of like test flag so that we wouldn't actually order things. But as I was using it, I still got like notifications that my thing was being shipped, but it would say test. Anyway, it was an actual challenge, right? And so they had deliberately removed this because they didn't want people to actually make requests. And it's very common that people don't plan for this scenario. You really need to set up some kind of sandbox API for people so that when they are playing around with any kind of explorer like this in the docs, they're not creating stuff that they're gonna regret later.
Hey Tom, can I pause for a second?
Yeah.
Quick? I'm gonna send around a order form for lunch.
Oh,
so
nice.
I'm gonna start it up here and I'll end with you, Tom.
Okay.
And if you have any special requests or anything, write it on there. We're getting Jimmy John's because it's easy, fast. All right.
Sweet. All right. Another part that is a core component of reference docs is the response example. So just as the request is just a sample of what you might request, the response is also a sample. Because remember, if you have different parameters, you're going to get different responses. And so one parameter that says, hey, I want the format in JSON, will have a different response than one that says, I want the format in XML. You don't have to show like 15 different responses, right? You just give an example. And I'll talk more about, this is actually probably the most important part. And the Open API spec has a lot to say about this, but in short, throw an example in here. And here's a example from, man, I put these together and then I've forgotten where some of these are. I thought I already showed that, so I was confused why I would show it twice. Okay, yeah, this shows this one is really worth checking out, by the way. Let's just browse this one. Okay, article search in the New York Times. Love this. It shows you, there's really not a whole lot here, but in terms of configuring this. But I believe this API Explorer is going to pass in some of these parameters into the request. But let's say we want to search for, I don't even know what I was, technology. I didn't want to say any topics. And nothing. Okay. Oh, try it out. Sorry. And now it wants an API key. Okay. All right. I thought it didn't require an API key and I don't want to populate it. So sorry. But you can see how once you plug in an API key into this thing, you can really start to see the requests in a fun way.
Can you just divert for a minute and talk about the API key? It's obviously something special that only special people get. And its function is?
Yeah. Yeah. The function of an API key is to authorize people. Every API, with the very few exceptions, will require this. It is
criteria that people use to issue the API key.
Yeah, yeah. So the API company, the company who has the API, wants to first of all monetize it and make sure that only certain people are making requests. They often have a free tier and then a paid tier. But let's say that the New York Times gives me an API key. And I decide to build a whole news site, and I'm making like thousands of requests per minute. And they say, whoa, the traffic spike from you is way more than what we signed up for. We're going to shut you off. They just turn off my API key, and all of a sudden, my requests die. I worked at a gamification company once, and people implemented certain requests incorrectly so that every time something was happening, it was calling constantly to get information. And it was like crashing servers. So they just turned off the person's API key. But also, it's a way to add pricing. They often say, for example, with the Aris Weather API, you can make 750 requests per day for free. But then after that, it's like tiered. And if you think,
I get it.
It's sort of essential. I believe I cover that somewhere else. So I've got so many different things floating in my head, I can't remember where, but it is a super important part. In almost any API, they have different ways of doing this. Okay, now I remember. We're going to dive more into this in the non-reference topics part, the authorization, so we'll get into more detail. But the API key is just one way There's lots of different ways, OAuth and some other samples. Okay. Probably the most difficult part of documenting the response is figuring out how to document nested objects. Because when you try to describe a response, you don't just have a straight list of key value pairs. You have, for example, values inside of an object, and these values may repeat for the same object, or you may have, you know, three levels of nesting. How do you describe that? For example, given name. How do I describe that? Do I do a table with name details and the second column is given name? Or what happens when you have, like, you know, five levels of nesting? Well, the table is not going to work. So there's lots of different strategies people try to use, and I'll talk about one that works well with the Swagger. But it's definitely a challenge, like the formatting. One very common design is this little tripane design. This was made famous by the Stripe API, which some people like to hold up as like the perfect example, and others are like, eh, it's not so great. I'm not a fan of the tripane API or the tripane design. You'll see this in other tools. We saw it in README. There's a free one called Slate that mimics it. The idea is that over here on the right, we're going to have a sample response. And in the middle column, we'll define all this stuff. So let's, for example, object. Or no, let's look at a real one. Amount. A positive integer, blah, blah, blah. Over here on the right, I could see this in context and see, oh, this appears as kind of a first level. But if I come down to another sort of section in here, I don't have to try to nest all of these. Like, these might indicate a parent, but you can see that we haven't tried to do any kind of crazy table columning. So that, I think that's what this design is trying to accomplish, is showing in context something and then just showing a table of definitions.
Okay, so the indentation indicates the nesting.
Okay. I would need to look and see. Let's look at here's the problem I have with these. There's no clear focus for the eye, so I don't know exactly where I'm supposed to be looking, right? But they also don't always track, like the two in sync. For example, if I want to know currency, it's not right here. It's, where is it? You know, it's somewhere over here. And now they're no longer in sync. Now it's like one thing's defined here, but it's shown here. And then it becomes more complicated than helpful. And this is actually showing the request, not even the response, I believe. So,
in this example, do they keep repeating that field then for every little section?
I don't believe they do. Oh, they have implemented show child attributes, so maybe that's why I'm not seeing something. So they do have some JavaScript going on here to try to make this more navigable. But you can see how this is a challenge in documentation, how you do this. Yeah, yeah. I've seen that before too, and I captured it somewhere. The fancier implementations tend to have some custom coding. I'm a fan, somewhat, of Swagger UI's attempt to do it, and I'll jump into it later, where they actually will show a definition in with the context of it in the same little space. All right, status and error codes. These are something that you might have specific ones related to a particular endpoint. But if they're the same for your whole API, you can put them in another section. You can put them in kind of the non-reference section or as a standalone page. But when you submit a request, if it's successful, you actually get back a status code that's like a 200. These are defined in the header, so you don't often see them. But if I were to let me see if I can do a quick example here. If I go into curl and clear this. I think it was capital I to include the header. Oh, man. Yeah, okay. So capital I says I only want the header, now that I remember that. So you can see if you submit a request, this status code is returned. Sorry, I didn't ignore that upper part. This status code is returned. The status codes are common for every type of API, every type of request. And it turns out there's lots of different status codes. There's even a fun status code in the Twitter API called Enhance Your Calm. It's a 420 status code. but the status codes actually have a rhyme and reason to their ordering. So 400s are usually problem areas, 200s might be more successful, and so forth. But if you really want to get into status codes, there's a whole Wikipedia page that has like all these standard status codes. For example, and developers don't often just make these up, right? You can't just decide, oh, I'm going to call my status code 204. No, that actually means something. That's a standard. It means no content. But your company might have specific status codes, like, hey, limit has been exceeded, or maybe you have like, sometimes they put secret information in status codes, and like nobody understands what the status code is because it's a cryptic abbreviation. And anyway, something that you would include. Okay, here's an example from the Flickr API. If we go to this, you can see their status codes, they decide to put them right there at the bottom. Hey, 100 is an invalid API key and so forth. But again, if these are common to all the different endpoints, I recommend just like linking to a page. And if you wanted to go the extra mile, your error codes could map to some kind of troubleshooting topic. Hey, you have a bad parameter. Here's a list of possible things you did wrong. All right, and finally, you might have some code samples on the page. This is probably something you'll see in the Aeris Weather API, where you've got so many different configurations and possibilities. Well, let's show some more code samples in context, maybe even a JavaScript implementation of it, you know. All right, so and you might want to show requests in a bunch of different languages. It just depends. All right, let's jump here. In my course, I go through a sample endpoint that we're making up for a surf report, for example. So let's say that we started with our Mashape weather API and we just had weather and weather data, but now we want to show like surf conditions. Well, here could be a sample documentation that would show this. You start out defining it or describing what the resource is. You list the endpoints, the methods, maybe it has a path parameter. You have a parameters section that has your path parameters, your query string parameters, and they're each defined. You indicate whether they're required or optional, the data types, this is an integer, a string. You have a sample request, often in curl. You have a sample response, and then you don't just leave the sample response. People may look at it and say, well, this is pretty obvious, but what is tide? What does -1 mean in tide or something? You go through and you define each of these, implement whatever technique you want to show nesting, and maybe add some other notes or so forth. So that's essentially what the shape of API reference information looks like, these different sections. Any questions, thoughts, concerns? Okay. All right, now we are pretty much done with that section. And we'll move on to the next part, which is going to be the Swagger and the Open API part.
One question.
Yeah.
Why did you shave?
Why did I shave?
Looks good on you.
With? Really? My mother told me, she said, Tom, you look foolish. And I was like, it's itchy too. I was growing facial hair as an act of rebellion, so I was no longer rebelling. Okay. All right. Anyway. Let's come back to the workshop activities page. And let me see if I have an activity around this that I've forgotten. Let me see. All right, we've done Postman stuff. We have a lot of activities with the open API and so forth. So yeah, we did mostly what I wanted to do here. So let's see, I guess we just took a break. So let's not take a break. Let's just keep going here. Unless you want a break. Do you want a break or not? We sort of just took one. OK. If you go back to the workshop activities page, go to learn API doc and activities. We're into part two. You can click the slides and open up the slides. Because I realize, you know, it's sometimes hard to see. And every time I magnify it, it like, you know, goes into responsive view and stuff. Here we're going to talk. This is getting into the fun stuff. This is where the rubber meets the road, and I love this stuff actually, because this is an area where so many people are clueless. Developers, product managers, and there's massive sort of conceptual stuff happening in this space. This open API thing is really somewhat revolutionary. So we're going to talk about what it is. We're going to talk about Swagger, what you do with them, and all of this stuff that we just shared about these essential sections that you have to document. You don't have to think, well, what template will I use and how will I ensure I get each section in every... No, you don't have to worry about that, because you're gonna describe all of that in the context of the OpenAPI's definitions. Of course, not everybody uses this, right? Probably only a third of APIs will have this that I've seen. But I think all should have it. So I think it's a best practice. It's also a best practice because it provides, there's so many benefits around standards. When you have everybody doing things their way, they choose their own terminology, they choose their own format, it's unpredictable. And it's hard too. They often forget parts. Having this specification will give people kind of a form to fill out almost. Okay. And again, this part is also there's a lot more detail in my course. I'm not going to go through really specifically all the different like parts of the spec because it can be very technical. But I'm going to give a high-level view of how you put it together. And let me start by telling a story of exactly what engineers want and how I got into this path. I was working at this company in San Jose, and we had a new API. And the product manager developed a very careful PowerPoint detailing these are the new endpoints and these are the responses. And he had actually copied, it was a team, he and she had actually copied the code samples onto these static slides. And they had a presentation that they gave to field engineers and said, here's what you can now submit, and this is what comes back, and this and so forth. And the field engineers were kind of bored by it. They were like, okay, as soon as they could ask a question, the first thing they asked was, can we try it out? Can we see it? Can we really see that response returned? I don't know if they were doubtful or skeptical about some things or if some things weren't clarified, but they definitely wanted to try it out. And from this, it reinforced the idea that engineers, they don't like static presentations. They want hands-on interactive experiences. I once had a neighbor who, he was a mechanical engineer. He needed to fix his car. You know, rather than taking it into the shop, he disassembled like 3/4 of the engine to replace the head gasket, had all the pieces around this whole garage. Whereas for me, that would be a nightmare. He loved it. He liked to get his hands on in the code. And I think engineers, software engineers, are the same way. They like to see all the pieces, play around with them. So how do you deliver this interactivity in docs where people can try things out, they can make these requests, get the responses, because you don't want to have just static docs. You want to have these API explorers built into the docs where people click stuff, they see the response. Because when you are working with the REST client with Postman, it's probably a lot more fun clicking and seeing stuff than it was just listening to kind of me explain every section, right, as a lecture. It's how people learn. If you think about complex scenarios, you can't describe them in totality because there's so many permutations, different combinations, different scenarios. People need a simulation that they can used to try out different things. What happens if I do this or that? And what's the response? You can't describe that all. You need some kind of interactivity with this. How are you going to build that, right? This is not something you just have to say, well, I got to sign up for a platform that offers it, like README. No, you can get this interactivity for free through Swagger and the OpenAPI. Let's do a quick demo. This is the Pet Store API. So go ahead and open up your browser. Go to petstore.swagger.io or search for Swagger Pet Store, one of the two.
Petstore.swagger.io.
Yep, you got it. Now this is, let me clarify terms first. A lot of people know the term Swagger. It was initially developed by a specific company, Reverb, and later purchased by Smart Bear, I believe. But at some point, people said, we need an open standard. We don't want to have a name that sounds proprietary or tied to a specific vendor. So let's rename Swagger to OpenAPI and reinforce the fact that it's a vendor-neutral open format. So at some point, they said, OK, everybody who was calling the Swagger spec, now call it OpenAPI. Well, like half of the web listened, and the other half just still calls it Swagger. I can't do this while I'm talking at the same time. Can somebody, let me see. Oh, number four. Oh, I see. Let me just put this down. All right, there we go. Anyway, so are you all here at Swagger Pet Store? Because this is a fun API. This is like a demonstration of an API. And this framework here is called Swagger UI. It's a project that you can download. And it is reading a definition that is stored here. If you go to this, go ahead and copy this and paste it into a new tab. And you will see that this is the OpenAPI definition for this API. Pet Store, there's not a real Pet Store API. Like, it is an API, but it's a fake one, right? You're not actually like creating pets and so forth. So the Swagger UI, you can paste any URL here, actually. This is kind of crazy. For example, if you are on my site in the Learn API doc, I've got a demo of a different API. Not there. Swagger UI demo. And so here is the same definition, or same kind of framework, right? Let's say that I wanted to instead paste in a different definition here. You can do that, click explore, and bam, it like loads that definition. It's kind of a really cool framework. At any rate, here's how it works. So you come down here to one of these endpoints. Let's add a pet to the pet store. Expand post. This is a post method to create a pet or to add a pet. And there are two sections here, model and example value. So the model is the description of each of the elements of it. And theoretically, if they actually had described it, you could read about each of them. But they didn't. They just kind of provided the data types. I'll come back to this later. But click try it out. Change the ID to like some whole number. Don't start with zero. Pick a unique number that nobody else is going to pick. Change the name of little doggy to like any particular name you want. I'll call this JSON doggy, whatever. Remember your ID too.
Wait, where do you put the name?
The name, replace doggy with something specific and replace the first ID with a different number. Expand pet here, because this is a fun part. Expand pet.
I did expand.
And you don't see Then click try it out.
Yeah.
And then this field becomes editable.
Okay.
I hear desperation or exhaustion. All right, 5-5, remember your number and click execute. And you'll see it submits the same request through curl and it shows you the response body. It shows that, it even shows the headers and so forth. So you've actually added a pet here. And if you were to come down to find pet by ID or get pet by ID, click try it out, paste in your pet ID, you will see that it returns your pet. Here's the Jason doggy. All right, so try that. See if you can create a pet and get your pet that you created using the Swagger UI.
I found the right place, but I don't find it. I entered the right information, and now what do I press to get it?
Did you?
Oh, execute.
Yeah, execute, yeah.
Which ID field is supposed to be?
Try the first one, the first one. And don't start with zero. If you got, if it worked correctly, your response should show something. And then in the get method, the get pet by ID method, you should be able to retrieve the pet you created if you successfully created.
By typing the number into the pet ID?
Yeah.
Integer?
Yep. Try it out and then click execute. This particular API lets you choose what kind of response format you want. So if you want, I think by default it's XML, but you can choose JSON and it will return in JSON. Yep, 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 right in the example value. Yeah, it's a little unintuitive that way, but choose something a little more unique. But yeah, and then change the name in the second part there where it says name doggy. Change that to something that you'll be able to recognize.
And
yeah.
And then I'm going to go back to the get.
Yep. Get pet by ID or get. Yep. You might have to click try it out again. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Did you get your pet?
I'm going to do it by name.
Okay.
I'm having trouble with that ID.
Okay. Anybody else still working on it?
I got 405. I got my pet back, but I got the 405.
You got 405? Hmm.
I got 200.
You got 200 is good. 200 is what you want. I don't know why. Okay. So the idea with Swagger is that you are combining experiential learning with documentation. Documentation is no longer just a static reading activity. You're actually trying it out. So it's like the best of e-learning and the best of documentation merged together in one world. And that's why it's so popular.
So
yeah.
So like Postman and Swagger, I guess, Swagger is similar to Postman except for the adds documentation standards.
Yeah, Swagger is pretty similar to Postman, but it adds documentation to it. And you can embed it right on a web page, whereas Postman is this downloadable client, right? It's not something that you just embed in a page, really. Okay, so, all right, so you've done that. Now let's move on to the OpenAPI specification. Right, because we briefly mentioned that at the top there was this thing in JSON, and we opened it up and it looked like this OpenAPI specification, and it defines all these different values, but we didn't talk about them. So we're going to dive into that a little bit. The basic idea is that if you are able to describe APIs in a consistent way, then we can build a lot of machines that can process that description and do cool things with it. For example, Swagger UI is one, but there are probably 20 different platforms that can read this structured description and do cool things with it. Essentially, this is structured authoring, right? It's not just freeform, choose your own templates. It's structured authoring. It's not XML, but it is a structure that's machine processable, can be machine processed. There are two versions of the OpenAPI definition or spec. One is 2.0, and if you look at this Swagger example, you'll see at the top that it's 2.0. It's actually not the latest. The latest is 3.0, but 95% of the tooling out there only supports 2.0, so you might have to convert between the two. If you're learning the spec, I recommend learning the 3.0 and then using a site called API Transformer to transform your 2.0 into a 3.0 or 3.0 into a 2.0. Let me just call out here, API-matic has a really nifty transform tool. You can plug in anything and get a lot of different outputs. You plug in your OpenAPI 3.0. Does it even, OpenAPI spec 3.0 and generate out the Swagger 2.0 or something, or OpenAPI 2.0. They're mixing the terms here. They're not really called Swagger anymore. So then this is a free tool. And they also have a bunch of other stuff on their platform. They would love to host docs and do other things. So you can do more with that, but I'm not going to jump into that. The OpenAPI spec has these core objects. These are all objects defined in JSON. But if you don't want to write in JSON, you can write in a format called YAML. YAML stands for, does anybody know? Yeah, it's a reverse acronym. It stands for YAML Ain't No Markup Language. So it's like it contains its own acronym in the definition. A markup language typically has angle brackets that identify things, particularly XML. But that becomes very unreadable. So people develop this format that, hey, we're just going to make things space sensitive, and like two spaces is a new level, and that is more readable and so forth. Anyway, it's another format that you can use. Most people write it in YAML, but it's really a subset of JSON. If you ever need to convert between YAML and JSON, you just Google convert JSON to YAML. There's a converter, you paste it in, they're interchangeable. But anyway, they've got these eight objects, and I'm not going to go through them meticulously here. Yeah, good. Making sure I didn't have anything planned for that. Because this is where it gets very tedious and very technical. And I think there's a better way as well. But basically, the OpenAPI specifies what version you're validating against, because this whole spec is validated. The info defines general properties about like whether there's a link to documentation externally and other information about the API, its description. Servers defines like the request URL, the base path. Your paths are all your endpoints, and this is the core of it right here, the paths. You define the endpoints, and then you've got below that the operation, the get, or the post, and then the parameters and so forth, and whether they're required. Components allows you to reuse stuff. So let's say you have 30 different endpoints, and you've got commonly used content across them all. Well, you can store those in components and then just reference them, and it reuses them. So it's nifty. I mean, we're all about content reuse, right? Security is where this defines the method used to authorize the requests. So it could be OAuth, it could be the API key, it could be basic key. Tags identify, this is very simple. This is just a way of sorting all the endpoints. Let's say you have the 30 different endpoints and you've got some related to games and some related to groups or something, you can tag them with these, and then in the Swagger display, it's going to sort them. So these are all tagged with pet. These are all tagged with store. These are tagged with user. So it's just a way of grouping things. This models part here, honestly, I don't know why they include it, but this is the components part that reuses parts of it. Anyway, you can just hide that, I think it's better. And finally, external docs is a simple object that contains a link to other documentation outside of it.
Tom, can I have a question? And I was out, so you might have already
said No, probably not.
This, but is this, are these parameters unique to the specific version of the spec?
Are these parameters unique to this version? Yeah, these are unique to the 3.0 version.
Okay.
The 2.0 are highly similar. But 2.0, for example, will say definitions, I believe, instead of components. And the 3.0 tries to improve on a number of things. Pretty much most people can describe APIs similarly using the 2.0. But 3.0 does have some features. For example, let's say one of the responses. No, let's say your request format can be any of several types of a JSON body. Like you could have a JSON body that looks like this format, or it can look like that format, or this format. Well, that's called an any of JSON schema, and that's only supported in 3.0. So things like that. Probably not that common. When you start to work with this, you will become familiar with the specification documentation, which is on GitHub. And if you go here to OpenAPI specification, you'll see a link here that says current version 3.0.1. And this documentation is thorough. It's exact. It's not very user-friendly. So it's all on one page. Apparently there was, you know, I once made a criticism on their Google group. I said, why don't you break this up? You know, this is crazy. You've got just like this huge page. It would be a lot more, you know, it would be easier to navigate this if you like put each object on its own page. And they're like, no, the developers want the simple control find, and I find it right on the page because you're moving up and down. And it's like, oh, I kind of see the logic to that using it. So I'm sure they would love it if somebody came along and said, you should really do the doc like this, and here's an example. But they don't. There is another reference, a tutorial on Swagger's site as well that gives more of a human tutorial. But this contains the bulk of what you need to know, and you'll use this. But basically, here's how you use this documentation. You've got these 8 different objects. And let's say you are trying to figure out what to put in the info object. Well, the info object contains these properties, title, description, and here's a sample in JSON or YAML, depending upon which one you prefer. It always lists them both. But you can see that it's got, okay, a contact, and it's below this, indented twice, is name. This means that name is an object inside of contact. So you've got an object inside of an object. Anyway, when you're working with this, if you have even one space out of place, it won't validate. So it's super, super picky. All right, and this is probably the simplest one. The path one is a lot harder. Let me just call attention to one part of my site where I tried to make this easy. I've got a tutorial here that walks you through each of these steps. So you would start out the OpenAPI object is the simplest one. You just, where is it? It's basically that. That's all it is. It's nothing really. But I walk you through each of these sections. So you start out by, you know, if you wanted to code this by hand, you start out with the OpenAPI object. You're going to add the info object, you know, probably just copy and paste this into a text file, into an editor that I'll explain in a minute. The servers object. Again, very simple. Then we get into the paths object. You start out by defining, and again, you're not going to take this in right, you know, here. You'll learn this when you actually have an API you're documenting. But this defines the different endpoints and then the methods below it. Then you add more to it. There's all these properties that each operation object, as it's called right here, can have, right? So you kind of add these. And then you go through and you figure out what properties. Well, here I took half of them away because they're unnecessary for this example. And then each of these parameter, like each of these things has its own object. So this is probably the most complicated part of it, is you've got the path object, the operation object, which can have various properties, and then each of these can have its own properties. And it all has to be meticulously defined and validated in order to work. So you can code things by hand, and you'll become a power player. But then if you don't document an API for 6 months, you might forget it all, right? So it's kind of frustrating. And part of the problem is that treating the spec like this, it's usually an afterthought to the design. Like, the API has already been designed, and here I'm just like describing it using this really complex format. And it's not really the intent of this design. It's not the intent of the OpenAPI spec. What people intend with the OpenAPI spec is that you will model and create a prototype of what your API should look like, and then people test it against users, and then when everybody's agreed to it and you've got it all described in the OpenAPI, then you hand it to developers and say, okay, code this. Because the problem is that people say, we need an API, this is what it should do. A product manager writes some requirements in Word. Developers go to town and they make guesses for things that are not defined or specified. And they're like, here we are, here's the API. And you put it in front of users and they say, this is unusable. This is so crazy, you know, these definitions are the same and this doesn't make any sense. And then they're like, crap, we should have designed it better, we should have done more testing, and you've wasted all this time, but you've already committed to ship date, so you ship it, and then you have to start versioning it. And when you have a version 2, suddenly things become more complex because you've got to still support version 1. And so Agile does not work well with API documentation. You can't just constantly iterate and change things because developers have already integrated this stuff in their applications. So you have to continue to support it. That's why there's this huge effort towards spec-first development. You want to get the spec developed first and tested and kind of agreed on before you code it, so that you don't have version 1, version 2, version 3. Because the versioning thing is a nightmare. Okay, questions, thoughts, comments?
Standard, no matter what's being developed.
Yeah.
Every company I've ever worked with, the specs are the last thing that gets done right before shipment. But I don't know if everybody's aware of, probably are, a website called Nexus, where lawyers go to find their online search. And I know someone years ago whose brother was working there, and she stated that they would not allow any of the developers to code for 2 years. They made them design the spec because they could not have the more than 4 seconds downtime per year. So they were like the ultimate, and you know, we got to think about this, we got to model, we got to, and they just would not allow them to actually write code.
Oh, that's a good example. So let me just summarize it for like. So you've got an example where your developers for 2 years are kind of just modeling things before they actually code them. That's kind of an extreme. The challenge is that there's a lot of negativity towards waterfall, right? It's like antiquated. And people say, well, isn't this just waterfall? Well, not really. This is the defense, is that once you've got this open API specification, you start doing agile development on this spec with your tests. You test it, you make changes, you test it, you make changes, and then once you've got it to a point where it's good, then you code it. All right, so now we're gonna get into, yeah.
So the company that I work for does create their APIs in Swagger.
Yeah.
Okay. They don't want, they don't want the tech writers to use the YAML editor because they can't see what we're changing. So if they give us the JSON file, we import it into the YAML, we make changes, export it out, they then add that back to Swagger and can't see what we've done. So what we are doing is we are writing and defining all of the field descriptions, all of the parameters, all of that outside of Swagger, and then somebody has to manually put that back in. Is there a better way to do that? And if this class is not a way to discuss it?
Let me back up a little bit and address your question. So, okay, so first, you're saying that in your particular company, people want you to somehow take your descriptions and your content and port it back into Swagger.
Yes.
All right, so there are two, I didn't really explain this part because there's a confusion of terminology that I need to clarify. You don't have to hand code this definition, like this thing here, right? You don't have to hand code this. Developers can put certain annotations in their code, similar to Java docs annotations. There's different libraries that have different like syntax for the annotations that they will put in depending upon whether they're working in Java or something else. And then they can run this library and generate out the file. So they can generate this file from the code.
Right.
And that's how some developers like to do it because they're used to documenting code in code with annotations. And I'm guessing that's what you mean when you're being asked, how do we get your edits back into the code annotations where the Swagger is being defined by developers?
I literally write this documentation in a Word file or a XLS file.
Yeah.
And give it to them and they then put it into their Swagger.
So you write it in a separate document and they pull it in there. Okay, so if your company embraces that, let's say you want engineers to write and
they're not writing, they're just copying and pasting my stuff in there.
Then I would, if I were you, see if you could get access to their source code to make those edits yourself. I'll talk about this later, maybe if we have time, but basically I would say try to get them to give you access to a specific branch, make a branch of the code. That's a copy of it. You're not going to screw anything up. You go into the branch, you make these edits using whatever annotations are correct. Like look at other examples of how the things are annotated in their code, the parameters and so forth. Make your edits in that branch. Push your branch and say, okay, you can merge this branch back into your main master, and they will see if like it breaks anything. But you don't want to. Well, you really want to be working close to that source and not be dependent on them to do it. And really, if all you're doing is pasting it back into there, there's really no value in keeping it there. Like, in some ways, I hate it when developers do it like this because it takes it out of the tech writer's realm for the most part. There's no advantage to having, I mean, it seems like extra work if they have to copy your content back into there. All they're doing is automating the formatting of this thing.
Well, the reason they do that is because then it is extracted to our website.
Why couldn't you just produce the JSON or YAML open API definition and push that into your website separately? Like, is it part of some big, large release process? If so, you know, you may have requirements, you may have to work through them, but.
Well, like I said, I didn't want to ask if there was an easier way than that manual process that we go through.
I think the better way is to not try to generate them from code. But then again, it's easy to sit here and say that rather than be within the constraints. Yeah. The better way is just probably for you to get access to the code and put them in yourself and manage it in a branch.
All right.
That way you have more control. A lot of times they may be like, oh, we're not going to give anybody access to this, and you may need all kinds of tools to even get in, get set up, but that would be ideal.
Thanks.
All right. Let me move into I thought I heard something there, but let's move into one of these activities, workshop activities. Come back to where we are here. We are going to do Swagger Editor. So if you jump down to Swagger Editor activity, Swagger Editor is where you could, if you're hand coding this thing, you'll probably want to work on there. Oh, crap. Okay. Let me... Okay. So if you just search for Swagger Editor, you've got access to it. All right. sorry. Let me come back to something. Where am I? All right. Paste in this YAML file into the Swagger Editor. So I've got a YAML file that's already got a sample definition. So what you're going to do is click this, and it opens up into a sample weather API. I went through that sample simple toy API from Mashape and documented it using this Swagger definition. You can see that actually one of these endpoints that's super long is the bulk of it. But go ahead and copy this. Go back to the Swagger editor that you're in. Okay, and you're going to paste it into the Swagger editor, editor.swagger.io. All right, and it should validate. So tell me if you've gotten this far.
Yes.
Okay. Now, this updates in real time, and it's a pretty handy editor. I mean, the error messages aren't so great, but it's quite a nifty thing. So go ahead and change some aspects of something, maybe in the top definition of this is a sample. And you can see that it's automatically adding that over to the right. So if you're hand coding this thing, what I like to do, and I know this sounds pathetic, but if you start from an API that's already valid, and then you replace it little by little with your own custom code, that actually works pretty well. Or you go piece by piece building it up and making sure it's valid along the way. What can be difficult is if you already have the whole thing coded and you put it in here and you're like, oh, this isn't valid and this isn't valid here, because it only, like, their validator reads down to the place where it's not valid, and so you might fix it and it doesn't read the whole thing. But go ahead and do something that makes it invalid. For example, I'm going to type something like that there. Oh, that was interesting. That didn't actually break it. Let me do something in the path, okay? So in the AQI path, I typed something for get so that it wasn't there, and now you can see that it doesn't even display this AQI. Usually it throws an error message, so maybe I didn't do a big enough error. But if you do a syntax error like this, you can see on the side it's like bad indentation of a mapping entry, and this is quite common. You know, if you have things that aren't indented correctly, it's going to throw up errors, and basically you would have to fix them to make sure that things are working right. It can be kind of frustrating and tedious getting everything right, and you'll consult the spec and be like, oh, this is supposed to be indented, or this is the name of the property. But by looking at lots of examples and going piece by piece, you can do this. All right. This Swagger editor will show either 3.0 or 2.0. You notice at the top we've got 3.0 pasted. And you can save the file, you can do what you want. Now, if you wanted to use this in a more commercial way, the product that they have from Swagger is one called Swagger Hub. So just to let you know, like, what is available at the commercial level, which is not much, but this same weather API here, it's using the same Swagger editor. right? So if you go to Swagger Hub, you'll see, oh, it's the same editor, but it's got like some extra features. And if you were to go and look at this API from an end user's perspective, you'll see that up on the right, you have these same buttons. You can download the code in all these different languages. You can create these client SDKs to download the code for use in these different languages. So this is super helpful. You can auto-generate these SDKs, and they may not be perfect, but they can get people started in whatever language they want. For example, let's say you've got a Go application, right? You can download a Go SDK just from your definition. All right, now I want you to, okay, we're going to do our own Swagger UI using a YAML file. So go to this activity number 2, Swagger UI, and open up and download the Swagger UI project. Go over here to where it says clone download and click download zip. All right. Let me go piece by piece through here so we don't lose anybody. Tell me if you've got to this page and you've downloaded this Swagger zip.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go back and do it one more time for me.
Okay.
I'll watch very carefully.
Are you at Swagger UI right here?
I'm not.
Google Swagger UI GitHub. Oh, or wait, I probably had a link right here. Yeah, sorry, I had a link right here. On the activity Swagger.
Okay, I'll go back here now. I have to look down and then up and down and up. Okay, so I'm at activity Swagger. Good.
Click download Swagger. Open it up on a new page. Over here, there's a green button.
Okay, I'm not there. I'm at part 2.
Okay.
API and Swagger.
Yeah, scroll down a little bit more to activity colon Swagger UI.
Got it. And download Swagger UI.
Now, click the green button here once you're on the Swagger UI download. Yeah, and then choose download zip. Wherever it lands is fine. You're gonna open it up, uncompress it, and inside there's a folder called dist, for short for distribution. Copy that folder. You can ignore everything else in there. Paste it somewhere convenient, like I'm going to put mine under workshop exercise right here. Right, so you've got the dist folder. Dist folder, so you could leave it in the download, actually. It's just you have a lot of other clutter. Now, this is the built version of Swagger UI, open source, that you could incorporate anywhere. You put it behind a firewall, whatever. If you, Chrome blocks this for some reason, so this is why I said open this in Firefox if you were looking at things to download. So it might work in Safari, I'm not really sure. But if you have Firefox, go and open this file, the index file, in Firefox. Can I just do that? Yeah, all right. So Firefox won't block the JavaScript locally. Of course, if it's on the web, Chrome looks at it fine. It's just locally that Chrome has like some kind of security things that block it. But you should see this thing locally. So tell me if you've got this open on Firefox or some other browser and are viewing it.
Yes.
OK. And then now one more step. Open index.html in a text editor. So Sublime or Atom, whatever you want. Actually, let me clear that away. You're going to go into the dist folder and open the index file, index.html. So if you were a Power developer, you could go in and change other kind of things and then recompile it. Maybe there's a make file, I'm not even sure. But if you just want to use Swagger how it is, you can, and you don't have to go through all that. You just grab what's in the dist folder. And in this index file, it's very, very brief. There's a URL parameter here. Look for URL colon. And you'll see that it references the JSON schema. So in order to customize this with your own OpenAPI schema, sorry, OpenAPI definition file, all you have to do is replace this with a reference to your file. And it's that simple, really. So let me come back to the class exercises. Right here where it says, save this file locally, right? This is that OpenAPI definition. Open it up or right click, save as, and save it in that same dist folder. All right, so I'm just saving my YAML file in the dist folder. Okay, I'm gonna come back into the URL here, and my file that I saved here and downloaded is called openapi_weather.yml. Sorry, it's probably way too small to see. openapiweather.yaml. All right, now I come back into Firefox, refresh, and voila, I've got my own definition loaded.
Sorry, can you show us again which element it is that we're editing?
Yeah, you're just editing the URL element, and you can put a relative reference. If you know, you could put the full path if you don't have this file downloaded, but typically you would download it. Yeah, so I'll give you a few minutes to get that sorted out. I mean, this is probably the simplest way to deliver your OpenAPI file.
So the URL element is on line 34?
No.
Line 7.
Whoa.
77.
Yeah, 77. Trying to see where you're seeing line 34, but.
And we should just change the last. But what are we doing to the URL?
You see, you're gonna replace the pet store JSON file reference with openapi_weather.yml, which is the name of the file that hopefully you downloaded.
API weather. I can't see it.
Yeah, openapi_weather. You should see that file in the same directory where you've your same dist directory if you saved it there. openapi_weather.yml. It could be called whatever you want, but that's what this file is.
In the directory where we opened up the DIST, you should see it there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, have you downloaded it yet?
No, because I got lost.
Okay.
go. I can take a shortcut, right? Just tell
yeah, me sure.
OpenAPI weather.
Yeah, but you need to download it from the workshop activities page. Let me go to that. If you're back over here under the workshop activities page, step 3, save this file locally. Sure. Okay. Save that file into your dist folder.
Now, when you're taking and putting the parameters in OpenAPI and the objects and all that stuff together, is there another app or location where you combine all that stuff together? I understand that once it's created, you can import it and export it using the different tools. But where do you actually go? You don't put it in a Word doc.
Wait, so what's the question? You're saying where do you put all these files?
No, how do you create the file itself with the individual pieces? Like, I understand.
Oh. How do you create the file? You know, you can just open up any text editor and create a file called OpenAPI whatever .yml, and if you use Atom or Sublime Text, it should syntax highlight so that things are more readable for YAML or JSON. Or really, probably, you might start using the editor instead, like start in the Swagger editor online instead, and then when you're done, download that file or copy it. The Swagger editor actually caches stuff, so if you If you leave something in there and you close it, it's still going to be in there when you open it, but I wouldn't trust that. This is part of the separation between the open source Swagger editor and the commercial Swagger Hub. Swagger Hub, you can save your file there, you can have people collaborating on it, you can have line comments, you know, they built functionality around it. But I mean, if you don't have it, then you can just save a file locally. It's just a text file.
Okay.
All right, so does everybody have something that looks like this? Who is still trying to get this set up? One person, two, three, four, five. Okay. I will I'll come around and help briefly. Let me see if people are getting stuck in a certain way. Wait, you had your hand raised over here?
I did.
You did.
Is it in the index.html or is
yeah,
it in the
it's in the index. Okay. Scroll down. Scroll down. It's line 77.
Okay.
Yeah, right there. So you should just be able to put OpenAPI, whether no HTTP.
Okay.
Assuming you downloaded this file, right? Okay. Yeah.
It's the same question.
Okay. Yeah, line 77 is where that URL parameter is. Oh. Fail to load spec. What browser is this?
This is Chrome.
Yeah, try to load it in Firefox and it'll work. This is Chrome blocking it. Yeah, for reasons, don't know. Yeah, you got it? Okay, good. Anybody else? All right, over here. All right.
So, how do I decompress that?
How do you what?
Decompress that.
Oh, so you have it downloaded and click download? Download zip. All right. Now, let's see. Just open it up. Like, click the little arrow there. Oops, little arrow. Show in Finder. Yeah, show in Finder right there. Or in folder, sorry. And you should just be able to double click it. So it looks like you already did it once, but double click it. And then extract all. And yeah, that's fine. Just go ahead and hit extract. All right. Okay, now go into this folder and copy the dist folder and put that somewhere like on your desktop or somewhere where you can access it, find it. All right, and then okay. Then let's see. Have you downloaded the YAML file from the? Okay, so go back to the workshop activities page.
Oh, I hope I didn't.
That's all right. I'd rather be writing.com/learnapidoc.
Oh. All of this minimized.
Yeah, just find a browser window somewhere. There you go. Click one of those guys. There you go. I'd rather be writing.com. There we go. Okay, and then workshop activities. Scroll down to this section right there. Save that file, click or right click and save file as, save link as, there we go. Mm-hmm. Put it in that dist folder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is
I think
this
you,
it?
No, where'd you put it? You put it on the desktop, I think. Yeah, there you go. Okay, so just save it there. Okay. Oh, wait, no, you pasted the dist thing. Try clicking that again and save. Oh, there you go. There's your thing. Go back to the desktop there. And now dist. Okay. And you have two folders? Yeah, sure. Okay. Wait, how come? What?
See?
All right, just hit save. Just hit save. All right, now, do you have a text editor? Open up a text editor. Like Sublime or Atom. There you go. So now, okay, so go and open up that disk folder, file open. No, I mean from here, like from file open. And find that. Okay, click your desktop, dist, and find the index. Okay, and line 77.
Okay.
You're going to replace this value with OpenAPI underscore weather dot YML. And then try opening that in Firefox. But no HTTP, just a straight file.
Okay, OpenAPI.
Weather underscore dot. Wait, sorry. OpenAPI underscore weather, I think. Let me see. Okay. Dot YML. All right. I will continue to help anybody who needs it here in a minute, but I think we are ready for a break. Well, here's what we're going to do after the break, just so you have an idea. Well, there's two other sections. One is, maybe I should try to think. Are we ready for a break right now? Is there food?
We're going to go get food. So they'll be here in like 15 minutes.
Oh, so we got 15 minutes. So it probably makes sense to take a break in 15 minutes. Then. Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll wait for that. We got one more activity then. This makes sense because we're still in the OpenAPI Swagger thing. We're going to do activity under part two, OpenAPI with stoplight. All right, so stoplight is a new product, and I don't have that much experience with it. I only used it on one project, but it's pretty cool. So what this is going to allow you to do is to work with the OpenAPI definition within a visual modeler. Basically, it's a GUI for creating the OpenAPI definition, and it's a pretty good one. So download the desktop app, and you might have to have a stoplight account. So if you already have GitHub, it should log you in with GitHub, and then download the desktop app. You can also just work with it in the browser, but one of these apps tends to work well. I don't know why they give so many options. I downloaded the Mac one, and it seemed to work well for me. But you should have something that looks like this editor, when you're set up. All right, so How many people already have Stoplight downloaded and installed?
It didn't work for me.
Three? Okay. Four. This, I think, is a really worthwhile tool. So go ahead and let's start from scratch here. If you go to stoplight.io in your browser, click the V3 technical preview. Their version 3 is much better than their version 2. It will prompt you to log in. And you can have it log you in through GitHub if you have a GitHub account. If not, do whatever else to log in. And once you're logged in, let me know.
Where's the
V3 button
that we're supposed
to click? It's the button right here. Okay. Yeah. Let's see. Maybe we won't spend time trying to figure out the. Let's do. Right. If you don't want to download the app, that's fine. You can just do the browser based. In fact, that's probably easier. Right. So once you're there, sorry. Let me go back. It'll say, okay. Let me come back to that. Oh, now I'm in it. Okay. So once you're logged in, you'll see a screen like this. Click New Project. If you have the web app downloaded, great. You can work from there. I guess there's really no clear advantage to having it versus using it in the browser. But yeah.
So if I already use this for work, should I do personal projects so I don't like mess anything up? Oh,
you actually use this for work already?
Yeah.
Oh.
The SendGrid V3 API is.
Sweet. Sweet. Oh, yeah. Some put it in some space, maybe personal projects, whatever. In a.
Doesn't show up on our website.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't. Or if you have a different account or something, we're just gonna have you make a sample, little test project, and you're gonna paste in an open API definition into it. Stoplight's whole philosophy is that you really want to build around this definition, and so you make it accessible for different partners and people on the team to kind of model and brainstorm and build it, and then you have services on top of it. So the fact that you've got a GUI makes it more accessible to other players. So who, have you got to this page right here, new project, are we good? Okay, you click new project, create it, call it whatever you want, and then it should send you to a page that looks like this. Once you're on this page, click the little page thingy at the top. What does it say? Files.
Mine says new workspace. Am I in the new API?
New workspace.
That's the old
stop. Yeah, did you click V3? The V3 technical preview button on the homepage? If not, go back to that stoplight.io and click V3, because the V3 is way better than the previous one. Okay, once you're on here, click main OAS. OAS is usually short for Open API specification. And it has a sample API in here, but we are going to replace this with our own, okay? So what I want you to do is go back on the workshop page, which I seem to conveniently go away from. Workshop activities, open API and Stoplight. Download, or don't even download, just click number 2 here from main OAS, open the code tab, and paste in the content for this 2.0 JSON open API. So whereas the Swagger editor, you can use 3.0, you can use YAML or JSON. In Stoplight, you've got to use JSON, and it's got to be 2.0, right? So I think you have to use JSON. I'm not entirely sure. But copy this 2.0 JSON definition. And in Stoplight, click the code tab down here and paste, delete what's there, and paste in the new definition. Oh, please. Oh, yeah. Paste in the new definition and replace any extra little things at the bottom. All right, so I know I went through that fast there. So you've got on the workshop page, you should have this little section that has a link to a Swagger 2.0 spec. That's what you want to copy and paste into Stoplight. So I'll give you a sec, and then click Save. I'll give you a sec to get to that point. Yeah.
I'm really struggling with all the various tools, and like they require JSON, they require 2.0, they require 3.0. Like I've been writing a 3.0 YAML spec.
Yeah.
And then like I convert it to 2.0, and like and then I have to learn like the nuances of 2.0.
Yeah, so you're saying that it's kind of frustrating that the tools between 3.0 and 2.0. Right now, like most of the tools only support 2.0. I don't know why they're taking so long to update. I recommend writing the spec in 3.0 in YAML, and then using API Transformer to convert it to 2.0 JSON if you want to work in Stoplight. I mean, you don't have to. This is just an optional tool.
I'm looking for Swagger 2.0 on your activity.
It should be right under activity open API with Stoplight. Search for the word Stoplight on there.
Yeah, I have the open with Stoplight.
And it's step number two has a link to a big long link to a file that ends in .json.
It's a weather 20. It's not 2.0. Yeah.
Yeah. So you click that. Well, up at the top it says Swagger 2.0. See, okay, so copy that.
Copy the entire file. Yeah. Or the link.
Or copy the code at this page. Like Control All, Control C. And then back in Stoplight.
Do a new project. I clicked on new project.
Yeah, new project. And then the main.
Project.
Sure, call it whatever you want. It doesn't really matter.
Well, the create project button doesn't work.
Try clicking. We'll name it something, and then below.
Now create project.
There you go.
Yes.
All right, and then in the upper left, click the little page icon thing. It says files. There you go. And then click main OAS 2, right? Right there.
Main OAS 2.
Now there should be a, you might want to just click the X there. Click the code tab.
Code tab, huh?
Highlight everything and delete it.
Where's the code tab?
It should be down at the bottom. Between, you see like a visual, yeah.
Everything highlighted, click delete key,
yeah.
Backspace.
Wow. Wow, I don't know what to tell you. It seems.
Can I just do paste? Will it, because I've got
yeah,
it
try
in
paste,
the bad
try pasting.
And then you just paste
Swagger 2.0. No?
That yeah, but it's not the one you pasted. I don't know why you can't delete something.
Okay, fine, that's pretty interesting.
You should be able to delete that.
Copied all and deleted, but I tried, but okay, fine.
There you go. Now delete that too, if you can. And now paste. Oh, wait, but did you?
Like this? Leave the red curly bracket?
No, get rid of that too. Oh, just go ahead and paste. Hit paste and we'll delete that. All right, now remove, go down to the very bottom, remove the extra curly brace that we couldn't get rid of earlier. No, not that one. Wait. You need one more curly brace because you accidentally, or hit Control Z again. There you go. Just these last two, the last two curly braces. There you go. Now switch, hit save. All right, so hold on. Yes.
I can't save because of the
Scroll down to the very bottom. Is there, wait, can we? We need to see what's there. There's two extra curly braces there at the end that don't get pasted. All right. There's kind of a subtle sort of copy and paste glitch thingy. If you're getting a invalid error, see, my thought was that you just delete the existing one and paste it, but it likes to leave two curly braces there even when you delete it, and these get put at the end. And then it says invalid. So just look at the end of your definition and remove these guys. But just make sure you only remove those.
We don't have an invalid.
Okay, if you don't have it invalid, you're good.
It's okay to have eight errors, but invalid.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
If I do, yeah. I don't know what the errors are. I'll have to find out.
I thought they were for fun.
We'll have to find out. Oh, yeah. Oh, it must be. Okay, never mind. Don't worry about that. Thing is, I think when I converted from, when I did it, I had some features that were 3.0 specific, so I don't know what happened there. Anyway, yeah, we'll have to see. All right, so how many people have got it in their editor? Most people, cool. Let me just give a quick tour of how this guy works, or this little UI works. And you can populate it. You don't have to start by populating it from an existing definition. Normally, you would probably just do it step by step. But first, you've got like your general definition and description and so forth. And you specify things like, oh, this is the host and so forth. Well, here's where it gets interesting. Click on expand, for example, weather data, and click one of the options under weather data. Now it gives us a GUI for working with this. We can specify the method here. We have the endpoint definition, the description. You can use markdown here. And then there are three different sections where it groups things: basics, request, and responses. And you can go through here, and at any time, you can always toggle to the code and just grab the code. It will default to the part you're actually working in. So if I make an update here and say, you know, whatever, hello, and go back to the visual editor, you'll see that it syncs between the two. You know, it actually lets you go between the two. A lot of times systems, you go to the code view and it's like read-only, or it's way confusing, but this is a valid spec over here.
How did you switch from code view to the visual?
You switch down here with tabs at the bottom, visual and code.
Thank you.
Yeah, and sometimes maybe the UI won't let you do some more sophisticated description, so you'd switch to the code. But if you come into this first section, basics, you've got different things that you can add here. Expand the request. You can add your query parameters. You can see this one has two query parameters, lat. And you define what the data type is here. And if you click this little icon, this little book icon, you can add a description. This one doesn't have much of a description. But basically, this gives you a lot of different options to describe things. Expand the responses section, and this is where it gets the most interesting. You remember this response that we had for the weather data was really, really complex. Let me just remind you what this looks like. Let me go to, where did we have it? One second. Okay. So if you remember this weather data part here has a monstrous response. It's got a query object that contains a count object and results and so forth. And some of these are arrays and some are some aren't, and some of the values are integers. If you're documenting this by hand, it is kind of a nightmare in OpenAPI. It's confusing, it's hard to do, but here is the magic, and this is why I think this tool is worth checking out. Right? If you are, let me come back to my workshop description. Let's say that you have this really nasty, gnarly response that you've got to deal with, and I've got a sample here. Copy and paste this guy. Go to the workshop thing. Copy and paste this, because this is kind of mind blowing. Instead of having to go through and line by line describe this thing, the stoplight tool will automatically do it. So I'm gonna go ahead and copy. I'll give you a second, or maybe I'll demonstrate this a couple times. In the responses section, already there's an object there, right? So I'm just going to create a new little path here, a new sample operation. Okay. If, let's say I had this response that I had to deal with. Click editor. If you click this generate from JSON button, you paste in the snippet of JSON that you want to document. And now you click generate, and you'll see that it is automatically like documented it. If you look at the raw schema, it has gone through and described each of the components with like what they are. This is JSON schema documentation that the OpenAPI spec would use. So you can save yourself lots of time this way by just using this little automated tool. To take it things one step further, in your response definitions, you want to give an example of things. So ideally, I think this is actually missing in this current version of their interface, but it would be coming. You want to go and give examples of each of these properties. We're not going to do this. They have added it. My bad. for example, let's say this example of three or something. When you have examples for each property in the response, then when Swagger UI reads your OpenAPI description, it will dynamically pull all the examples from this schema definition into a sample request body that looks, that is kind of whole unto itself. Let me give an example of what I'm trying to say. Let's take a look at this Swagger project here. This get weather data has a response right here, right? This is not just one chunk of code that I pasted and then defined somewhere else. These are all examples that are defined in that schema definition. This model here, if I expand this guy, it shows the definition of count, for example. It shows an example, shows the data type, and all of these example values are dynamically pulled into the example value here rather than stored separately. And you want to do this because a lot of times when developers give you information about the API, they'll say, here's an example value, and then you start describing it and so forth. But you don't want to have the two be separate. You want to generate the example value from the example properties in your schema definition here. And I realize I don't know if I've articulated that very well, but the Swagger UI gives you a nice expandable, collapsible kind of view of these things. It does a nice job of putting the description with an example with how it appears nested in it that I like. So you can kind of go through here and see the structure of it. The only problem with Swagger UI is it is whoever did the UI design, I guess they ran into challenges because when you have stuff that's long, it just sort of breaks out of it. And it needs its own space. You can't make this fit a narrow width. It sort of has too much space. Anyway, maybe better tools will come along and fix it. Okay, sorry that wasn't that exciting. But I found that was very helpful when I was documenting something the other week. And I was excited about it because I spent like half the day trying to figure out how to document a JSON schema, any of property. But in general, like this GUI, once you get familiar with it and you work with it, like you can just start focusing on the content of the definition rather than the format. And that's where I think the real value comes in. I mean, imagine if you had to write a blog post in YAML format that was really specific. Like, it would block the whole creative process. You'd be like, well, what's the syntax and what's the format? You can't create content like that. You have to create content in a flexible space where you can see things and you can work with the actual substance and not worrying about the format and the syntax. Even if you are working in Ditto, a lot of times people write documentation in more of a simple format and then they decide to port it into the XML schema that they need when they're done. And I think this tool, by giving visual design around it, is kind of allowing you to do that, to focus on the actual substance. This does have some other features, just FYI, like you can host documentation on here. Let me show an example. I think their classic one is ShopGate API. There we go. You can have more of a fully hosted experience here where you have both your non-reference content, your tutorials, and your reference content. You know, a lot of these portals will give you one or the other, but they bring it together. I haven't used this for you know, hosting documentation, but it sounds like SendGrid is using it. Is that what you're saying? Or just for the APIs, or what?
Just the APIs. So if you, I don't know if you want to pull it up, but you go to sendgrid.com/docs.
Okay.
Nice and slow.
Oh, that's probably the network here. Okay.
And then go to just have a SendGrid API V3.
All right.
So this is actually just an iframe right now, but built in.
Mm, okay.
Got the little try it out tab.
Nice. And, you know, I like, one thing I really like is how in their request body, you've got like an easy toggle between the schema, which is the description of the request, and the example. I think that works really well. And here they've got collapsible sections. So, you know, that conundrum or that challenge I said about how do you format and describe something that's nested and hierarchical and multiple levels. Look, they even have like a show more part. Looks like a pretty robust API response here, right? So were you the one who documented this? What was the experience? Can you comment?
So we're nested under a developer experience team.
Okay.
So most of this was done when I started in May. And my team lead used to do Watson API documentation.
Oh.
So right now we've been sort of splitting things up. I do a lot of UI documentation and she does a lot of the API stuff. But I'm here because if she wins the lottery or wants to go on vacation, I would like to know how to have a blank look on my face if the developer starts asking me questions. So
yeah. Well, good. You said your team also works on the Watson API? I thought that was an IBM thing. Okay. Yeah, those guys have a ton of APIs.
Who's hungry?
Looks like we're time for a break. Okay, let's eat. And we'll come back. And after the break, we have one final segment. We'll talk about the non-reference content.